Hey yo, it's Brett here. Mo and I had a chance to sit down with superstar writer Greg Rucka while we were at the Calgary Expo. We got to have a little bit of juice and sit in his hotel with him. So this is that interview, and I'm betting you're going to enjoy it. One of the first questions now, you live in Portland now.
I do, yes, in Comic Central.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of creators seem to...
Yeah, you can't throw a brick without knocking four or five of us down at this point. It's...
Do you just all go hang out? Is that...
No, actually, we don't. We some of us do. Like, Bendis does a semi-frequent get-together at his house on Friday nights. And you never know who's going to turn up at that. I've been there when, you know, Matt Fraction and Kelly C. DeConnick have been there. We bring our kids. They bring their kids, and the Bendises have four kids. You know, and Randy and Rocky Bowen have shown up. Scott Alley from Dark Horse shows up. Mike Oming and his wife Takisoma show up. Dave Marquez and his wife Tara will show up. I mean, so you never know. Dave Walker is there quite frequently. I mean, so you get interesting sort of conversations about. It's mostly industry gossip at that point. Let's be honest. It's coffee clatch, you know. And I've been meeting with artist Matthew Clark for coffee since 1999 now, regularly, used to be on Tuesdays, I think now it's on Wednesdays, and Neil Bailey, who does the webcomic Curate Ipsum, often there, Frank Beaton, James Lucas Jones, who's my editor at Oni, I mean, so there is, the social stuff is there, but most of us, at least on the writing front, I think, spend most of our times with our asses in the chairs in our basements, working. So we don't tend to get out. So you kind of need an excuse. You need a thing where it's like, okay, let's go and talk to other human beings.
Hence why you go to a con? Is that kind of...
Well, I love going to, well, no, I hate going to cons. I love being at the con. There's always a moment before I leave where I'm like, I don't want to do this. I can't afford the time. Because I lose the travel day, right? You don't work on a travel day, so that's 2 days gone. Most often, you're too exhausted when you get back into the room to do any work. And I'm behind on everything right now. I mean, I'm literally swamped right now. And so every time the convention sort of looms, it's like, oh man, it would be so much easier. And that's not counting all the stuff that you're leaving behind at home with your family, with, things that need to be done. Once I get to the show, it's invariably wonderful because it is exactly that. It's an opportunity to get to see people and talk to them. And, the internet is a wonderful thing, but the internet is also a toxic hell cesspit. And people tend to be better behaved when they're in front of you. And also, I think there are people who are... The hostility in some quarters of the internet are such that, people do not feel safe to speak. So there's that. And there's also, it's always good to meet people. And it's always good to get out there. And so I do enjoy that. I absolutely enjoy that. It's just, it is exhausting. It's funny, I ran into Mike Oming in the lobby. We're talking about, oh God, I don't know how many more of these I can do. Bring on every convention you can. I'm 44 now and I'm slow. I mean, I'm slowing down. And I'm slowing down in every respect, I think, And it's starting to become difficult. I think I'm doing one more show. I'm doing Big Wow in San Jose, California in mid-May. And I think that's it for the next couple months at least. I got to get some work done, man.
What is an average work day like for you? Do you kind of structure your day, or is it kind of...
I try to. We have two kids, and so the day is sort of governed by what's going on with them and what needs to happen. So I tend to get up between 6 and 6:30 in the morning. I'll deal with immediate correspondence. I'll pour some coffee in me. Get the kids to school, and I'm back by about 9. and then, you know, try to get into the office and work. The biggest distraction is that phone calls start to happen. There are always calls with people who, you know, either directly related to what you're working on or work that's coming up or whatnot. So I've been trying to institute a no phone policy from 9 to noon or like 9 to 2.
Yeah.
And about 2 in the afternoon, I have to knock off work because then the kids are getting out of school. And then we have all the after school stuff. So, you know, either it's lessons for one or the other, or it's a basketball game or a soccer game or a theater performance or something. Then dinner. We tend to eat early. And then the rest of the evening stuff. My son's now 14. And he's entering that age where, and they've done studies on this, adolescents need to stay up later. Their body clock has changed. So you could tell him you got to be in bed by 10, but all he's going to do is lie there being like, well, I'm awake. And my daughter, who's going to be 11 at the end of May, has never, ever enjoyed going to bed. What she enjoys is sleeping. She sleeps like nobody's business. I mean, she sleeps like a teenager, and she has for years. You put her in bed, and when she finally goes down at midnight or whatnot, she'll sleep until 11 in the morning, you know, if she can get away with it. So depending on the wrangling situation and how panicked the deadline is, you know, I'm back in my office by about 9, and I'm working probably for another 3 hours or so. Yes, I am.
I'm Mark McKinnon. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Hi, guys. I'm Mark.
Hi there. Yeah. Nice to meet you. Brett.
I'm Will. Hi, nice to meet you. Were you there yesterday?
Yeah.
That's my wife, Kathy, by the way.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
How'd you do? Was it quiet? Or?
No, it was nice.
Nice show.
Yeah.
Really nice show. Where are you coming from?
Portland.
Oh, horrible. New York. we're still sleep deprived.
Yeah, so if it works well, you have to splice that, but if it works well, I'm going to be back at my desk by about 9-ish, and I'll get maybe another 2 to 3 hours of work in, but again, you know, fatigue starts to set in. I was trying to work last night, and I was literally looking at stuff that I had already written, and I was like, I can't focus on this anymore. These words mean nothing. That's the ideal, but, you know, life happens, and things get disrupted. And I try to, you know, so that's the weekdays, and then on weekends it's whatever I can steal, mostly at night. A lot of the writers I know work night hours, and they're very smart to be able to do that, but you have to have an infrastructure that will support that, and, you know, Jen and I can't do that, because Jen writes too. So, you know, it's daytime hours.
So,
I could have asked about four or five follow-up questions on that alone, but then I'll take over, so Brett, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask about, because you do a ton of research. I mean, that was one of the things that Ed really kind of, you know, established with us. And I know from having read a lot of your work now is that your research. So is that part of the work time then?
Yeah, though it tends to... It's project dependent. So, for instance, I'm writing Lazarus, and I'll hit something, and I'll be like, okay, well, I need to look at this more. There's sort of a base level of research that happens before a project is begun, and then as the work is continuing, you know, you go in search of what you need, or you go in search of things that will elaborate it. And part of what I'm doing in my morning, you know, that 6 to 7:30 zone, checking my emails as I'm going through my news feeds. You know, and I've got subscriptions to a variety of news sites, and they're anything from, you know, biotechnology, genetic stuff to I've got a Strat4 subscription, which is sort of a public. It's a pay service that provides. Basically, open sourced intelligence analysis. So, you know, you pay for a subscription to the site, and then you can sign up for things that you're interested in, and you'll get emails. And some of them are analyses, some of them are news briefs, some of them are opinion pieces, some of them are essays. And there are a lot of real smart guys and gals working in that place, and I get, on average, about 60 emails from them on any given morning, and I tend to cull very quickly on, like, this might be useful later, this is an essay by Kaplan, I want to read it, this is an analysis of what's going on in Syria, I don't need to be that depressed right now, I'm not really interested in naval group movements for the next month, I am interested in, you know, geopolitical meetings that are happening in the next month or whatnot. So that research sort of, you know, gets assumed in. When I'm on, like I said, something specific, and then again talking very specifically about Lazarus, I'll hit something and I'll say, okay, well, we've got a bit in issue 9, you know, which is the actual lift proceeding, right? It's where waste are, the people who are called waste are allowed to basically come to an open call, and they present themselves for selection. They are hoping that the family will go, you have skills, we will lift you, you will become a serf, and we will educate you, and so on, right? But the way they do that is that there are a whole battery of tests, right? So now I'm looking at them, okay, well, you have a population that may well be illiterate, right? How do you test them, right? Because Carlisle's going to be, they're greedy. They don't want to waste a resource. So just because you're illiterate, doesn't that they can teach you to read, right? So I'm researching different types of intelligence tests based on visual cues, right, rather than, or audio, rather than intrinsic math problems, right? They're not going to put an algebra problem in front of somebody, you know, if they have a reason to believe they've never seen algebra. So I'm looking at, okay, well, what sort of stuff do you do? And how would that be done? What sort of medical stuff would you do? How would that be done? So, and the other part of that is that for Michael, who works in a very, it's not photorealistic, but I think of it as photojournalistic. He does a sort of documentary style. It's important to give him as much reference as possible, because otherwise he has to dig it up himself, and that will slow him down on his end. So simply as a courtesy, I'm trying to get better about saying, I have images for you, I have references for you, I have links for you, I have YouTube video for you, or whatnot. So, long answers.
Oh, that's great.
That's great, yeah.
Well, let's see now. Just going back a little bit.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Portland winds up figuring into your work a lot, mm-hmm. and I know that...
I'm not sure how much a lot is.
Well,
certainly Stumptown.
Yeah, well, Stumptown, actually, I noticed it in Wolverine when I was reading that as well.
Yeah, that was, I think, the first time I stuck it into a comic, mm-hmm. and I did that simply because I was like, Portland is absolutely his kind of place.
Right, yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's interesting because I noticed definitely with Stumptown and how the art really establishes Portland as a place, and so is that really important to you to have that kind of, you know, place established?
Again, it depends on the work. You know, in Stumptown, the city is a character, and the book is named after the city, and it's a particular kind of Stumptown. You know, it is a take on Portland. It's not the Portlandia take,
right?
You know, there are elements of it, I suppose, but it is it's a little more grim and gritty, and for that, yeah, you know, I want the city represented as accurately as is reasonable. For the Wolverine stuff, it was less that, okay, this is this location on, you know, Burnside, as much as it was, I wanted that sense of Pacific Northwest, because you're looking at, you know, I mean, Logan, at least ostensibly, was Canadian, you know, and that sense of putting him in an environment where there are lots of trees, you know, and where flannel is considered appropriate clothing, you know, that made sense to me. And I really did want to do, I'd been reading some stuff about militia groups and things like that. And in Oregon, the state, the interstate sort of divides the state into sort of one-fifth to the west of the interstate, and the cities on the interstate, and then four-fifths to the east. And as you move further and further east, as you get closer to Idaho and so on, you get up into high desert, you get the population density just plummets. That's where you get, you know, meth manufacturing. That's where you get all the things that you would want to do without people seeing you do it, right? I mean, that is a natural thing. there's space and people use it. So, and at that point, I've been doing a lot of research that had come up, and I was like, well, I got to use this. So,
so then in the case of Wolverine, and I'll ask you this, because now the first two arcs of that story seem very, you know, like he's Logan, he doesn't dress up in costume,
yeah.
There's no real superhero story. And then the third one features Sabretooth and gets a little more superhero. Now, that was that your choice, or was that more?
Yeah,
of
I mean, it's a hard balance. You know, one of the goals with that book at the start was this is what he does when he's not in costume. So we didn't want him in his costume. There are certain characters, I think, you are limited in the kind of stories you can tell about them. One of the problems with Logan is that he's not really a main character. He was always, I think, meant to be a strong secondary. He was supposed to be, the equivalent would be Hawk in the Spencer books, or Mouse. If you look at the E.G. Rollins novels by Walter Mosley, you know, Logan's ability was to come in and be anti-heroic when the heroic solution wouldn't work. The societal shift that was occurring at his introduction is the same societal shift that says we're going to have a Batman who kills people. Right, this is why we're going to break Bruce Wayne's back and we're going to bring in Jean-Paul Valley. And with Logan, because arguably Logan is much more straightforward in that, and he's a cool character, there's, you know, he has grown in his appeal to be, I think, incredibly high marquee. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but you look at his story, and what are his stories? They're either myth, right? They're about his own myth. Right? They're related to his origin in some way. They are, and Sabretooth and so on fall into that, right? Or they are going to be situations where he is encountering a problem, and we know how Logan's going to solve these problems, right? So it's personal mythology, or it's direct problem solving, or it's stories with the X-Men, which sort of can combine the two. So if you're writing a solo book with him, you know, he's going to encounter, and what we wanted, Derek and I really wanted him to have him moving through the world, you see how he's going to resolve these things. But the thing that we always, the biggest problem with Logan in those situations is that he kills people. And he's not necessarily happy about it, but he's more than willing to do it. So, kind of like the Punisher, his stories end a certain way, I think, in the main. And so we went to Sabretooth because we wanted to do the mythology story. And also, if I remember correctly, and you're asking me about a book I wrote a long time ago. If I remember correctly, there was some agitating from Marvel being like, it's a Wolverine, man. Why aren't you having a Wolverine? And I said, you know, our response was, this is the book we told you we were going to do. And they're like, okay, yeah, but I think we were the first people to take Wolverine out of the top 10 in like 15 years. It was amazing, you know, I was like, so, you know, and I liked, it was fun writing the Sabretooth stuff, because it's fun putting him opposite somebody who really gives as good as he does. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite moments I think I've ever written was Logan parking the car on it. I mean, I just love that as a solution, being like, I can't kill you, but I can sure as hell keep you there for a while. You know? You can only do that to certain characters.
That's right. Yeah, actually, it's funny because that's one of my favorite takes on Wolverine that I've ever read. Like, I'm not actually that big a fan of the character, but when I read yours, it was just like, oh, no, that you get, because I think you get it.
Well, it's weird. You know, I think every writer comes in and they have their own take, and we had a take on this guy. And one of the things we wanted was that he's old. Yeah. He's an old man, and he's tired. And he's also, and this is the thing that I'm actually more annoyed by when I read a lot of interpretations, is he's also pretty darn smart. You know, he may not be a Hank McCoy genius, but if you've been around for as long as this guy, you certainly have acquired an experiential base, and that experiential base is going to inform your choices. I love the idea that, you know, and it's a total conceit, but I love the idea that he takes a week, and he always, you know, he just takes a week every year, and he has a reading vacation.
Yeah,
there's a guy who goes somewhere and is like, I'm going someplace where I'm not going to be bothered with all the books I want to read. That's a guy who to whom books are important. You know, that is a primary knowledge source. And I do think that, kind of like Frank Castle, he's a deep thinker. You know, you don't, a lot of the the folks that I've ever met who do work that we consider dark or difficult don't talk about it, right? The cliche Logan line of "I'm the best at what I do and what I do isn't very pretty" is a great description of the character, but at least to me is something that he would never say. That's something that somebody says about him, right? But he doesn't walk around bragging about it. You walk your walk, and he is from a time and a place where he walks his walk. He doesn't have anything to prove to anybody, ever. I mean, ever.
So. I'm going to jump in here, because listening to you talk about the character and how you kind of break down and go through and establish how you view him, you know, I think one of the things that you've written, you know, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, the Trinity there, and I think there's a perception.
You doing okay here? Yeah,
yeah, we're good.
So you good?
We're good.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much.
There's a perception there.
There's a perception that Batman's one of the easier characters to write. Superman's difficult. Wonder Woman might be the most difficult, simply because it's difficult for, I think, a lot of the fan base to necessarily relate to her. So,
I have issues with that, by the way.
Yeah,
but
and
we'll come back
to
that. But
I would like to get into you know, your blog about fangirls and how I like my coffee a little bit here as well, because, you know.
But I think your assessment of that, at least for me, is correct. I think Batman was very easy to get into initially, but I think Batman's deceptive that way. I think you look at Batman and you get him. And then if you start to really think about him, you have to start asking questions that are pretty crucial. I believe very firmly that if you are writing a character that is supposed to be a superhero, that they need to be heroic, and that means they cannot be broken, right? They can have flaws, and they can have their secret pain, and they can have their struggles, but they can't be crazy, all right? And the argument that Batman is insane, which was really popular in the 80s, you know, with the Tim Burton movies and so on, has always been really offensive to me, because that says that he's not a hero, and he is a hero. He's a dark hero, but he is a dark hero who uses actively that sense of darkness to pursue his agenda, right? So it's very easy to fall into, well, Batman's sort of the Dirty Harry, right? And at first blush, certainly following Frank Miller's take on the character, you can get that. There's got to be more going on there, and you've got to be talking about a guy who is exceptionally compassionate. And we can talk about Batman for hours and really get into that. Superman's more difficult, I think, not so much because he's alien, but because his power set creates a completely different bundle of storytelling problems. But the thing about Superman is he's probably the most human of all of them. And once you sort of realize that, and you realize what you are writing about is you're writing about a man who is the ideal of the best we can be. And then what he's got is he's got this alien power set. But you see, all that's been refuted too, right? Because it's boring if he's heroic. Right.
And a steel ending?
Well, and just look at the way New DC is treating him, right? They don't like that. But the fact of the matter is that the idea inherently in him is that, ignore the power set, here's an orphan who is raised by a couple that embody the very best of the American dream ideal, right? They believe in fairness, they believe in honesty, they believe in integrity, they believe in a sense of justice, they believe in doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do, right? They believe in being neighborly, you help your neighbors, right? That's the boy they raise. And then it turns out that boy is bulletproof and can throw tanks and can fly, right? So that to me is, there's a beautiful elegance in that. The way you hurt Superman is emotional, right? Those are the best stories, are the ones where he is feeling. The problems aren't, how is he going to solve the problem? You know he's going to solve the problem. But I think a lot of people shorthand and they go, oh, that's boring, and so on. And maybe it is. I don't think it is. Diana was the most difficult for me because Diana is very complex. And that comes out of their origins. If you look at Batman's origin, you can say it in a sentence. It makes perfect sense. You talk about Superman's origin, you can say it in a sentence. It makes perfect sense. Talk about Diana's origin, and it does not work in a sentence. It is a very complicated origin. And it. The other thing is that, and I've said this elsewhere, is that the moments of creation for each of them influence the characters. You can create Batman 75 years ago. You can create him today. All you have to do is add zeros to the Wayne fortune. You still get the same guy. All right? Superman can come to Earth 80 years ago, or he can come to Earth tomorrow, but as long as he lands in an idealized Midwest, right, where he is, who raise in him those beliefs, you're going to get Superman. The problem with Diana is that she's created as a political character. She is inherently political. And not only that, but the politics are abundantly feminist. Well, feminism means something totally different in 2014 than it did 70 years ago. That's different. All right? And then you add on all of the other trappings, all the bondage gear stuff, all of... No, I mean, it's deliberate. See, this is the thing. There's a reason, that, you know, that's not a lasso, that's a whip. All right? You know, they were called the manacles of submission. She's wearing dominatrix. She's wearing dominatrix outfits, you know? And that's very deliberate. That's in her design.
I've only laughing picked that up before until you pointed it out to me. And I feel stupid for missing that.
No, because... But the thing is that in the stories, we're not interested in exploring those things. And with good reason, right? So... We're left with a rather confused mythology and a character who is, in many ways, the most alien of any of them, but who, at the same time, is, you know, she is a message character. Batman's not a message character. Batman is not telling you, what you need to do is get out there in the middle of the night and beat up muggers, all right? And Superman can be interpreted as a message character, but he's not really. He's not an agenda character. Diana's an agenda character, and DC has forever tried to divorce that from her. But the problem is, if you do that, you break her. You create a different character. She has to stand for something. She has to stand for a belief in a better world, a belief in gender equity, and from that, everything else that comes, right? She is an ambassador. She's a warrior priest. And I think that, you know, DC has been very fond, and they would say this over and over on the book. They're like, oh, she's unrelatable, she's too perfect, and so on. It's like, no, she's not. You know, that is a lazy, lazy bullshit argument. It's not. You know, any character is interesting if you give them their time and their due. I mean, you can get in their head and you figure out how they see the world, why they make the choices they make. Diana was the hardest character for me to get into the head of those three, but by far the most rewarding. By far.
It's actually, maybe it's a subtle thing here, but I mean, you constantly refer to her as Diana, not as Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
And that tells me that you've passionately gotten inside her head and you feel like you understand the person.
Well, but I tend to refer to all of them on first name basis. I think there's a difference between, for some of them, it's a crucial difference. You know, Batman to me is always going to be Bruce. You know, Superman to me is always going to be Cal. But Diana is always Diana. I don't tend to interchange Diana and Wonder Woman as often as I do Superman and Cal or Batman and Bruce. And that is, you're right, because Wonder Woman is a title that she never gave herself, right? And I think that she, frankly, there's a story to be told in how much she detests it. You know, Superman and Batman very much self-names, right? I will become a bat. Yeah. Superman doesn't go, I am going to become super, but it's an appropriate name, and he's got an S on his chest.
and it's a family symbol.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I'm fine with that. I actually have no problem with that. You know, talking, I was trying to remember who I was talking to. I got a friend who's Native American and is desperate to reclaim the swastika as a positive symbol. And it's like, good luck with that. I mean, really, good luck with that. I hope you can do it, but I don't see that happening. So that was a digression.
That's awesome. Well, I want to go into, like, because you actually, when you got into comics. I mean, you did Whiteout, but it's kind of a twofold question because you mentioned Hawk, and so that leads me to think of your Atticus Kodiak novels because they're they have that same feeling to me, and I'm a huge fan of Robert B. Parker as well. But so the first one I noticed had a lot of references to comic books. So I mean, did you kind of want to get into comic books?
Oh yeah, no, I wrote my first comic scripts. Literally trying to write a comic that would be published while I was in college. This was before I wrote the first Kodiak novel. I was writing fiction, and I was writing prose. But, you know, I was a comics fan. I wanted to do that kind of storytelling. Just my career trajectory was such that I left undergrad. I went to USC, the Master of Professional Writing graduate program. Because that was the one I got into. And as a result of that program, my master's thesis was the first Kodiak novel, the first unpublished Kodiak novel. That got me a literary agent. That led to Keeper eventually being published, which led to a career as a novelist. All that time, you know, I was a comics fan. And from the time that I think the first novel was published, I was agitating. You know, I would go to San Diego back when you could just go to San Diego for the con. And, you know, I would get in front of editors and I'd be like, I wrote these books. I would like great comics. And they would say, get away, kid. You bother me. And I was very fortunate that I had a high school friend who had been working at Fantagraphics, ended up working at DC, put my novels in front of the people he was working for. That ultimately led to Oni Press and doing Whiteout, which then sort of cycled back and led to me having a sit-down with Denny O'Neill. And that led to Denny saying, well, let's see if you can do this, write me a story. And all of a sudden I was part of the No Man's Land crew, and I've been, you know, hip-deep in comics ever since.
So. Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because you went from, Whiteout, your own self-published book, through Oni. And great book, got a great buzz, and everything like that. Terrific book. I remember getting it actually the day it came out. Before,
It was you.
We pick it up and go, this is a terrific book. And this Rucka guy is going to go somewhere. Let's see how long it takes him. Because, that kind of is it. Your trajectory, though, from Whiteout to, you didn't have to go into some of the smaller characters like some of the guys do.
No.
You went right to an icon in Batman, which is, to me, very interesting.
I was very fortunate, and there were... And it was more right place at the right time than anything else. I was, there were a couple novelists who had done it before, Lansdale, Max Allen Collins, Lansdale, of course.
Oh, those guys are great.
And these are guys who had clearly been, a foot in each camp. But what had happened was there was a bloodletting in the back group. You know, they got rid of three of, I think, their four regular writers. And the timing was such where I was, I was basically approached and said, if I thought you had any interest in writing Batman, I'd suggest you talk to Denny. And I was like, well, of course, he's the ultimate private eye. So that was stage one. Stage two was Denny had read my first novel and had enjoyed it. And I guess when Patty Jarrett, who was responsible for all this, sort of went to talk to him, she brought in Keeper and Finder, the first two Kodiaks. And before she really got a word out, this is apocryphal, I'm told that Denny was like, where did you get that? Meaning the second one. He didn't know that it was out. So Patty, said, oh, he's here in town. So Denny and I went to lunch, and we talked mostly about The Question, actually, because I still think what he did on The Question is, I think it's seminal. Right? It's grossly overlooked, and I think it's some of the best comics, certainly of that period. Literally, I would think I was flying back to Oregon that evening, and he said, well, why don't you write me a story and we'll see if this thing goes. And I think I drafted, it was the first Montoya story, I drafted two down on the flight. I typed it up when I got home. He had the script the next day, and he was looking to see, could I write in a visual medium, or was I going to be prosy and try to put all my words there? And I knew enough to know that this is a visual medium, and the purpose of the script is to explain the visuals, not to be like, look at my pretty, pretty words. So, and like I said, they needed writers. So they took a look at that and they start throwing more work at him, and all of a sudden, I mean, literally, it was like, there was work, and all of a sudden, I was involved in No Man's Land.
You know, it's a couple of questions. I could go a couple different ways here, but let's stick with that. So you come on your No Man's Land. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is because it is. There's certain parameters of what you're all of a sudden not going to be able to do with Batman because mm-hmm. they're changing the environment. So how do you kind of approach that?
Well, I mean, that was really... The thing is, No Man's Land was exceptionally collaborative, right? Jordan Gurfinkel had proposed it, and he had a master document. And so the writers would get together, and they would look at it, and there was a timeline breakdown. How are we going to... What stories are we going to tell, and how are we going to tell them? And in that, you know, we would get in a room or on the phone, and we would argue it, and we would hash it out, and then we would divvy it up. It was sort of a very nascent... precursor to the way 52 worked. It really is. No Man's Land is sort of proto 52, because it was in its own way a weekly, year long event. Right? And, well, it wasn't in its own way. It was a weekly, year long event. Every week you were getting a book in the Bat title and they would all relate. Some of them would relate better than others because some people played better with others. But it was everybody in theory pulling in the same direction. So, you know, it was very adrenalized, and it was a very exciting thing to be part of. I mean, it was a lot of fun, and that makes hard work easy. You know, you can get in there, and when everybody is ticking and tossing out stuff, you synergize. And it had the benefit of one of the best editorial teams I have ever seen. It was Denny O'Neill, it was Jordan Gurfinkel, it was Darren Vincenzo. I don't know if Scott Peterson was still there. And then I think Carlin was in the head chair, you know, he was editor-in-chief. And I think his trust in Denny was absolute.
Greg received a phone call right around this moment, and it was in regards to the MRA, which, of course, you know, brought up his blog. And that's kind of what leads into this next part of the interview.
They can go fuck themselves. Unapologetic. Yes. Think, yeah. You know.
I know.
Yeah, they're on the wrong side of history, and they're spoiled brats.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there are legitimate issues to be addressed, but.
And it's such I mean, we live in Canada, so it's obviously different. We were looking at it from a distance, right? I mean, you're living there,
yeah.
Seeing all this shit happen over the last, you know, 2 years. It's just
ridiculous.
Unbelievable.
I don't know if it's American culture that promotes such a societal acceptance of violence against women.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly not unique to the United States. We know that, you know, there are infinitely worse places to be a woman. But, you know, when you break it down, the idea that you would threaten, that, you know, threatening somebody with rape is a gendered attack.
Mm-hmm.
All right? It is even a gendered attack if a man threatens another man mm-hmm. with rape, right? Because what is that? I'm going to make you my bitch, mm-hmm. right? I'm going to feminize you. Right, and in that I am saying I'm going to weaken you. So this is grotesquely problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Any way you look at it, and the fact that somebody can do that and not think that that's wrong, not see that there is a problem in that, not see that this needs to be addressed, says infinitely more about them, you know, than it does about the person calling it out.
Absolutely,
I refuse to apologize for wanting people to actually be their best selves. God knows I'm not, but I try. You know.
Yeah.
And this, you know, some guy said, you know, made the comment, oh, you know, my daughter, and it's always a daughter. It's the same liberal code as think of the children. It's like, really, that's very ironic, because that's the conservative catchphrase. Think of the children. We're doing this to protect the children because, you know, society is destroying them. They shouldn't know about gay people. God forbid. God forbid. Because just the knowledge of it will corrupt them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's horse shit. Just horse shit. I just...
Well, this comes back to, obviously, that blog.
Yeah.
A couple days ago, obviously somebody, you saw this was at a convention, some misogynistic piece of shit put this shirt up that said, you know, something about I like, fangirls like my coffees and I don't like coffee, and then had an image of a coffee mug that's knocked over, it's cracked.
And it's like a sad coffee mug.
Yeah, and...
which indicts all of us coffee drinkers, too.
So. And it's an ugly shirt. I mean, there's well, like...
Well, but the thing is... And I mean, in the grand category of boys nailing up signs to the treehouse that say no girls allowed, that's a pretty innocuous sign compared to some that I have seen. Mm-hmm. All right. And you know, my understanding is that, you know, it was an in-joke between these guys, and they did a piece of art, and somehow it manages to be on a shirt. And, okay, fine. It's, the shirt itself is not the problem, right? The shirt is the symptom. The problem is in not recognizing the symptom and it being permitted to continue unchallenged in an environment where, like I said, in the grand hierarchy of sins, that shirt's relatively innocuous. It's not the same as threatening somebody with rape. But I would posit that if you said, I like my black people like I like my coffee and I don't like coffee, nobody would ever print a damn shirt.
Yeah.
In public, unless they were damn certain of who was going to see it, right? Mm-hmm. I like my coffee the way I like my Jews. You know, let's. I like my coffee the way I like my homosexuals, right? What that shirt is symptomatic of is defining and creating an other in a culture that cannot afford to be alienating anybody. If, and I was talking to somebody about this yesterday, take away all the political social stuff, just take it all away. The economic model is flawed. I mean, why the hell would I say I'm only selling comics to you, but I'm not selling comics to you because you wear glasses, and I only sell comics to people who wear glasses? Why would you do that, right? Why in the world would you do that? Nobody at Disney, right, is looking at the Marvel movies and going, well, we want to make sure women don't come to see this, right? That never enters their head.
Yeah.
The opposite does.
Yeah.
How can we get the most people to see this movie? Right? How do we get the most people to come in? How do we get the most people to partake in this? So just from an economic model, never mind the social aspects, never mind the societal questions here, it's a stupid economic model. It just doesn't make sense. And this is an industry that cannot be affording to alienate people. You know, this is an industry that is... You know, we don't have the numbers we should have. We need more people in comics if we want comics to survive. And it's just absurd to me.
Now, how much of this, though, I mean, we saw the, in the early 90s, you had the bad girl craze.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the hypersex, I mean, not that the male characters aren't, you know, I mean, the physiques are illogical.
Well, male characters are idealized, but they're idealized to a male gaze fantasy.
Yeah, but, I mean, and the female characters, though, I mean, even the characters that were more mainstream characters, mm-hmm. like the, you know, members of the X-Men or whatever, mm-hmm. at some point in time, they became hypersexualized mm-hmm. in order to, and I just think that this kind of permeates the entire problem. It kind of just goes through all the comic books and it leads to this shirt. I mean, it's a subtle thing, but it starts so much earlier,
I think,
right?
So, too, and I think one of the things we're seeing right now is, I'm old enough that, you know, I can go back and I can see the shifts. You know, there was a period where, you know, I live in a state that 10 years ago passed a ban on same-sex marriage, right? 10 years ago, all right? That's going to get overturned, okay? I mean, it's going to go.
Did so you in those 10 years, I'm just curious. Did that, were you like,
I was infuriated. I wish I could say we thought of not moving and we didn't, or we thought of moving but we didn't. I just remember being livid about it. But the point is, and the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, 10 years on, and it's abundantly clear the trajectory here, mm-hmm. right? It there is no question of it. It should happen sooner. It shouldn't have taken this long, right? But we are seeing a generation coming up, and they hold different values, and they are pushing for those values, right? That's how we get these changes. And you see the same thing in comics. You see the exact same thing in comics, right? You know, there were guys, you know, who were reading 20 years ago and now feel incredibly threatened, all right? Some of them, maybe much younger, and they don't know why they're threatened, all right? But I think that we have seen a shift in what we think is acceptable representation. You know, you're talking about a period where, sure, yeah, you know what? The women were hypersexualized. Most of the guys were white. Mm-hmm. All right?
Absolutely.
So we are seeing, again, societally, a shift to the world is more inclusive. You know, we're three white guys sitting around a table right now talking about this. But the fact of the matter is, we all recognize that the world is not for us. It's, we are participants in it.
My work environment, I'm in a room with six people. One white woman, myself, one white guy, a Native American mm-hmm. male, a Filipino female, a Filipino male. You know, that's the real world to me. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, and there's no issue, you know, it's never an issue of who's what or what. We're just people, and it's a good group that gets along because we recognize each other and accept
that's,
it.
That's the key, is that we're different.
That's
we're
okay.
All different people, and that's a good thing. You know, homogeneity is not good. So I don't know. You know, I think it's funny as hell that people are
gay. Yep. So, I mean, it's a perfect... group.
And that's out of six.
Yeah.
Right?
That's out of six. One other guy needs
to. And look, that's a snapshot of the world. You look at Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I've seen it called out on a couple of things, but if you've seen the show, one of the things they do beautifully is that squadron looks like New York. It is racially, ethnically diverse. There's, you know, the captain is gay and out, you know. This is what Brooklyn looks like. And pretending it doesn't serve anybody any good. You know, but I think there's a direct, you know, you can draw lines here. There's a class of white boy who feels very threatened by a world they don't understand. They don't understand how there can be an African-American president of the United States. So instead of going, well, my problem with him is that he's black, they go, oh, you know, nobody wants to, they are not willing to say, you know, it's called the White House for a reason. So instead what they're going to say is, oh, he's a socialist. Oh, he's not really an American. Oh, he's an Islamic terrorist. Oh, he's taking our rights. No, these are things that people believe.
You know, from the outside, I mean, I think there's a perception from other countries, like here in Canada, probably even more so, that okay, people are more accepting because he's had a second term. People, and mm-hmm. But you're saying that this is actually still
I think there's a huge element of the opposition, that what is quote-unquote Tea Party. I think a lot of that, a lot of that reaction is absolutely just naked racism. Mm-hmm. I saw somebody commenting that, you know, if Cliven Bundy? I can't remember. The rancher in Nevada who just held off the BLM with a bunch of cronies pointing guns at them. You know, if that had been an African-American with a bunch of his friends with rifles, oh, you guarantee that situation would have ended very differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would not, you know, it would not be what it is, and it would not be getting the coverage it is, right? You know, so... But, you know, your job is not to fix the world, right? But your job is to contribute to it being fixed. You know what I mean? And if that's picking up litter, you know, once a day, or doing a kindness, or speaking out when you see injustice, small steps matter. Because all together, it becomes massive. I think it's absurd. I mean, I really do think it's absurd that there's even this argument still going on. It makes no sense. Fake geek girl? I mean, what the hell? Mm-hmm. I mean, really, what? How does that threaten anybody? You know? I mean, really, how does that threaten anybody?
Well, you know, it's...
Are they stealing your movie tickets? I mean, could you not get the comic book? Can you no longer get into your store? I'm sorry that the line is a little longer at the con. You know, but the convention organizers sure as hell aren't complaining.
Well, we're talking to the spokeswoman for the convention, Emily Expo, a mascot slash spokeswoman, and she was talking about how the best thing about the convention is the people can come, they can be themselves, they can probably be a geek, they're not going to be judged, they can be the, you know, male, female, anybody can be down there and not worry about it. And tolerance is what we're talking to her about, what we could learn from Star Trek. She was a big fan of Star Trek. She said the tolerance, that was a big thing. And but, you know, I mean, I know some of this is from your, obviously it's a desire to help the world, and part of this is because you're a father and you want to see, you know, your children be protected.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's fundamental, you know. Any parent who doesn't want to, any parent who doesn't want, you know, a better world for their kid is failing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't think that the implication that, you know, I have skin in this game because I'm married and I have a daughter is it's flawed, number one, because of course I would, but number two, it shouldn't matter.
No.
I mean, it shouldn't matter. It has a more pressing concern for me because I see the effects it has firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I live with those things. But ideally, that's not why. You know, I mean, I'm not. This does not arise simply because. This is me looking at a direct causal, and being like, you know what, I've got to say something now.
Brett has a 6-year-old son who was conceived at the San Diego convention. Born to be a geek.
You're going to love that going out on the podcast, yeah. Aren't you? Thanks.
Born to be a geek. You know, and
he comes by it honorably.
He does. And you know, and look at him. He's the sweetest kid. He's the smartest kid. And he's into the superheroes. He's into... And, you know, I look at him and I go, there's going to be a point where he's at school where he thinks that's cool now and somebody's going to tell him it's not and it's going to be rough. And there's nothing that... I know it's got to be hard for Brett because... How do you protect him? You can't necessarily.
And you don't want him to change.
Yeah.
No.
Either. Because he's
just
a sweet kid.
You just want people to accept it.
Because
he's such a good kid.
And that is just one of the things I think that you want.
He's named after a comic book character, too. Tristan from Stardust. Born to be a geek.
See?
It's a beautiful thing,
I
think.
You know, I don't know. It gets silly after a while. You really think about it. It's like, this is really something. This is the mountain you want to die on? This is the mountain you want to die on? Okay. It's your choice. But you're going to die on it. And it's going to be bloody. I mean, it really is. Because you're going to lose.
Yeah.
You're going to lose.
Yeah.
You know? They are here. Whether or not you wanted the girls in your club or not, they're here.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to leave. And all you're going to do now is make it harder for you to accept them. Or make it impossible for them to acknowledge you. You know? I mean, it's just... So yes, there's been rage about it, and I think that's
silly.
Has
there been a lot of feedback to you before the blog? Have you been?
Yeah, I mean, I've been getting trolled a bit, and there have been so many people sending notes just saying thank you, or, you know, I read this and I passed it on, or I'm using this in my class, or, you know, so the response, the people who are willing to speak to me, and to sign their names in the manner of the people who are like, this is delightful. This was needed. Thank you. I'm not sure. I'm a little hesitant at the needed part. I'm not sure how to accommodate that. Because my intention was not... It was not... You know, I wrote it in a fury on a Sunday night. And I emailed it to Jen, you know, and I said, read it. And she said, you should post it. And I was like, I'm not sure I'm going to. And I had drafted it in, like, my little posting thing.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not sure about it. And she was like, you should post it. And so I'll sleep on it because, you know, type in, hit send in haste, regret, you know, regret at leisure.
Yeah.
So, and I thought about it. And I was like, you know, there's nothing in here that I'm ashamed of. I didn't write it as a call to arms. I wrote it as... This is what I'm feeling. I mean, I said in the intro, you know, I don't normally use this Tumblr for blogging. I'm going to do so now, you know, but you've been warned. That was me opening my head. That wasn't me going, I'm crafting an argumentative essay. This was me shouting into the storm. And in that, I was either exceptionally naive or just did not consider that it was going to get picked up and run with the way it has. So, you know, the responses have been wonderful in the main.
It's interesting because as you talk about this, I'm kind of reminded of the parallels to the Felice Romero character from Keeper, you know, and going through the Common Ground convention and how, you know, like the reaction from people was quite positive. So it sounds like you've got that same kind of thing going on.
Well, and I think, look, there's room for debate if people actually want to debate it. You know, the MRA folks keep coming back with their same arguments, you know, which is, well, statistics for men committing suicide are higher. Which I'm like, right, let's look at the whole study, and let's look at what the study doesn't cover. Let's look at the fact that women attempt it more than men. Men are more successful because men actually have more access to more efficient means to kill themselves. Women tend to use drugs, right? It's a longer course that can be treated, all right? Guys tend to use guns, all right? If you put a gun in your mouth, you pull the trigger, the odds of any treatment being any damn good are pretty low. Let's look at the number of male service members coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, who have committed suicide. Let's talk about the veterans here, all right? Let's talk about the number of queer and transgendered guys, right, who are committing suicide because they are being bullied and attacked by a larger male community. Let's look at those percentages, and then we can talk about this. All right? Then we can talk about this. But don't throw in my face, oh, more guys do it. Is the causality that more guys commit suicide because of women? There is a study, I saw a study saying that men are more prone to suicide if they're single. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? All right? Because when you're depressed and you have nobody to talk to, we get despair and we get alone. And having been through some severe depression, I know that you can be surrounded by people and still feel isolated and alone. You know, so there's a conversation to be had, but it needs to be a conversation. It can't be, you know, my friend Eric Krautman, I sent him a screen capture of one of these anonymous I hate you, fuck you notes. And I said, you know, what do you think? He said, I think you should find a Rorschach test and you should, you know, post as a response the ink blot and you say, what do you see? A vagina with teeth? Very good. Moving on. You know, because that's what it seems like. I don't think I need, actually more to the point, I do not feel I need to defend this. I don't. I'm right. And I rarely will say that. I'm old enough to know that very often I'm not. I'm right. That's what I'm right about. You know, basically because it comes down to the Will Wheaton rule, which is don't be a dick. That's what it comes down to. It doesn't matter. It's simply treat people well. Don't be a dick. Are we done? We're done. Let's move on. So.
Awesome.
Your turn.
Yeah, let's see if we can bring this back into books a little bit.
Oh,
yeah,
we like
no.
You want to talk specifics?
No. Well, I mean, I could. Right? I mean, I would love to, but that's.
Well, yeah, like I said, I can go. It's real easy.
I had a question because you brought up earlier about the, you know, about when you were writing for comics and when you got in and the fact that you let the artists. You know, you didn't overpopulate it with words and stuff like that. And so there is that concept of, like, letting the artists go. So, I mean, you really must have to kind of trust the artist a lot.
Yeah, well, I don't think you have a choice. I think when you come in as a writer who cannot draw me, one of the first things that you learn is what you're imagining in your head and what you're going to get on the page are very rarely going to be the same thing. And if you continue to cling to the vision in your mind's eye, you're going to make a lot of people unhappy, not the least of them yourself. I have trained for much of my life to use words well to tell a story, right? It would be absurd to me to go then to an artist who has trained for much of their adult life to tell stories with pictures and instruct them on how to do that. All right. The scripting process for me, ideally, is entirely collaborative in that I'm going to send a document to the editor and the artist, and that the artist in particular is going to read the document, and no matter how specific I get, is going to be able to read and understand the spirit as much as the letter, and that the spirit is infinitely more important. You know, one of the reasons I work well with Michael Lark is that Michael absolutely gets that. I can give him a script, and I know he's going to get what we are trying to do. And then he will make his decisions based on the best way to accomplish that, right? That's the ideal relationship for me in any sense. You know, I'm getting the same thing out of Russell Dauterman right now. You know, he's been terrific. We have not talked nearly as much as I think I would have expected at this point, mostly because I'm giving him scripts and he's turning in pages, and it's like, I have nothing to say here. I had one note on issue two, and it had nothing to do with his storytelling. It was a decision he made about how somebody was holding a gun. And I was like, could we not do that again? Here's why. And he was like, oh, yeah, sure. Everything else, you know. That talk about worrying about the cup holders on the Cadillac. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, it's, you know, the script is, for me, it is a living, revising document. You know, Michael is drawing a script right now that I'm still revising. And we are having conversations about it. In fact, he was sending me texts when we started this, basically going, how about this? And it's like, I can't answer that right now. I'm going to need to, but not yet. So, you know, that's the beauty of the form for me. It really is. It's one thing to be able to say, okay, here's the story. But if you embrace, I think you become a very foolish writer of comics if you do not embrace what the rest of the team brings to it, and if you do not acknowledge yourself as part of a team. There are triple threats out there who can do it all. You know, I can't. And I have never pretended I could. So I can be pretty arrogant, but that's an arrogance I'm not willing to go to. You know?
Well, actually, it's kind of funny because one of the things I've noticed is that sometimes when an artist takes over and becomes a writer, they're the ones who are overpopulating with words. And I don't understand why that is.
Well, I'm not sure I do either. You know, I think that writing comics is deceptively difficult. It is not like writing anything else. It's not like writing a screenplay. There are similarities, but it's not the same. It's certainly not a novel or a short story. It is its own form. And just as I have worked very hard to master what I do, I think I'm certain there are artists out there who have not given due consideration to what it is the writer does and why they make the decisions they make, you know? And I'm not indicting anybody in particular because I can't think of any examples, really. But, you know, I'm certain that it comes from that. I think it comes from a place where, you know, I love no-copy panels. I love panels where there's no dialogue, there's nothing, where it's all a visual moment. That, to me, is the epitome of the form, you know? The image should tell the story. And if you're working with an excellent storyteller, you'll get a book back where you don't need any dialogue. You know, that the only thing the dialogue is doing is enhancing it, but not explicating it. So
does it take a stronger feeling of yourself, concept of yourself, to actually allow your work to go out without pages of writing?
I think for some writers, certainly, I guess. It's never been an issue for me. It never has been. I know that I've been criticized. I remember, you know, doing the early Batman stuff and so on. And people would be like, I paid $2 for this 22-page comic. There was no words. And I'd be like, uh-huh.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah. Was the story clear? I mean, if you are equating your value in the book with how many words, I can give you, I can write by the word. I can do that. But that's not telling the story. It's never been... that's never been a problem for me. I'm not sure why, but I mean, I've always recognized the medium as primarily a visual one, you know. So
how about adjusting what you're writing, adjusting your writing style and everything like that to enhance the skills or recognize the skills of the artist?
That is something I've gotten a lot better about. When I started, I didn't really give it any active thought, and I'm somewhat embarrassed to say that it wasn't until fairly late in my writing career that I did sort of go, oh, hey, wait, you know, different artists are different, and trying to communicate with them about what they need from me, or what, you know, I mean, working on the Batwoman stuff with J.H., it's funny, they printed in, I think, the Elegy hardcover, they printed some script pages. And you look, and the script pages look practically anemic. And the reason they're anemic is because Jim and I would get on the phone for hours at a time, literally hours at a time, breaking down the issue and pages and sequences and saying, how do we want to do that? So, and I've said this in other interviews before, there would literally be points where I would say, this is that thing we talked about, period. And then I'd put the dialogue in, and then because we talked about it. We talked it to death.
Yeah.
So, you know, versus with Michael, you know, I'm giving him a very full script, and I tend to give him very actively too much information because he somewhat gleefully then reads the script and then goes through and he reformats everything so that he cuts out the stuff he thinks he doesn't need, and he puts it down so it'll print on one page, and then on the back of that page he'll do his sketches and his breakdowns, right? So I spent all this time formatting in a certain way, and then like one of the first things he does is delete all the formatting. And it's like, but that seems to be working for us, because I think in that initial read, what he's getting is, okay, this is the letter, right? This is what he's sending me to say, this is what we're doing, mm-hmm. This is why it matters. And then he goes, okay, knowing that, I can now make my edits. You know, but like I said, I came to that. I'm embarrassed how late I came to that. I think a lot of my early work would have been substantially stronger. There are reasons that I came to it late. Not all of them my fault. When I started at DC, there was a wall between artist and writer that you did not. Everything went through the editor. They did not want the writer and the artist communicating directly.
Really?
Yeah. And there are a couple of reasons for that, and some of them maybe even good ones. But that's not something that actually occurs anymore. But back in the day, one of the things that was going on there, I think, was that there was a fear of conflict. And, you know, the trains have to run on time, especially if you're DC or you're Marvel. The books have to come out. Mm-hmm. And you don't want a fight between artist and writer that's going to derail that. And that way the editor is always in the loop, right? The other thing that was going on is you have to remember that we were coming into email was just really starting to be used when I started in the industry. Prior to that, it wasn't really digital. And even when I was coming in, pages came in by FedEx. You know, they weren't scanned and sent. Artists would finish their page, and then they would pray to God that FedEx would deliver to them intact. And, you know, there were stories of FedEx packages being lost or tearing open, art being stolen. So all of that has very much changed. And I think because of the nature of the way that technology has changed, it allows for a different and I think a more aggressive, and I mean that in a positive sense, communication and collaboration. You know, I never, ever had conversations with colorists until I was doing really, working with Jim on the Detective Comics stuff and then Dave Stewart. Because Jim and Dave would be in very active communication, and I would get looped in on that. So,
One last question. I have one last question.
Well, ask your last question, and then we'll do some last words. So you can hype your stuff.
All right.
And we'll see if you can wrap. How quickly you can answer this?
If you were to take over one of the big two companies, complete control. Let's do a little role playing. I know you like you're role playing games and such, aren't you?
Yes.
All right, so let's do a little role play. You get to take over one of the big two.
You're asking me to burn bridges, aren't you?
No. I'm just saying if you could make three changes.
Yeah, you don't have to mention any names.
You don't have to mention any names. You don't have to say even which one of the companies it would be. That would be interesting to know.
If you could make
three changes, if you have complete creative control, three changes that you think they should make that would make the process better or better for the creators or just better for the fans or whatever, what would that be? Or is this...
Yeah, I think I'm not sure.
Folks,
I can't,
this
I'm
is
not
a visual. You should see he just slumped down when he's defeated Greg.
I'm not sure. I can give you three. I think one of the first things I would do if I were at Marvel or DC, if I was running it, and I'm talking, this is money is no object. I would increase the editorial staffs across the board. If not reduce the number of books, I would at least increase the people who have. There would be more people available to work on those books. I think one of the things that that the industry really is suffering from right now is that, in particular, the big two are in a cycle where they have to saturate the market, and that has a huge trickle down effect. It means editors are overworked. It means that writers and artists are having to work on multiple things much more quickly. Mistakes are getting made. So I think one of the first things we lose in the creative process the full power of what collaboration can be. And this is an art versus commerce issue, right? And this is why it's got to be money would be no object. So that's number one. Number two, I would, and this isn't even running Marvel or DC. I mean, this is just, because this could never happen. I would try to divorce the books from the studios. I think wetting the books from the studios is actually damaging to the stories being told, because it has turned the mainstream big two books into R&D. Everything now is in support of the IP. And the result of that is that the stories are actually secondary, right? And the more pressure you put on something to say, well, this needs to be marketable, we need this to tie into this thing, the more you handicap your creative teams in telling good stories, all right? One of the great things about DC when I was there in that period leading up to 52 was that the edict at DC, and Dan DiDio was a huge promoter of this, was tell the best story possible. It wasn't about make a big event. It was make the story as good as it can be. If you tell a great story, it will be its event, and it will bring people. And I think that's one of the reasons why the build-up to Infinite Crisis is so strong. And I think it's very strong. And it's one of the reasons why 52 is so good. And that's not to say that a lot of money wasn't made. 52 made an incredible amount of money for DC. I mean, they had a monthly book that sold very, very well. And it came out every week. They were cashing a check. But one of the reasons that worked was they gave us the environment to do it in. And from what I have seen at the big two, that environment is becoming rarer and rarer. There are those who survive in it and are able to relish in it and work in it. But for a great majority of creators, that environment no longer exists. They are given marching orders. The book has to do this. It has to be this. And, okay, well, then you don't need writers for that. And, you know, what you need are artists who basically will take dictation. And that's unfair to, never mind what it does to the artists, it's unfair to the never mind what it does to the writers, it's unfair to the artists. It takes away their creativity. So I don't know if that's three, but those are the things that come to mind.
Yeah, it's unfair to the fans too. I mean, really.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I get angry at the fans too, because they keep buying it. They know it's bad, and they keep buying it. And what they need to do is stop buying bad books.
Yeah.
I know you love Name the Character, but they're treating character horribly. And the way that is going to get better is that they're going to have to cancel the book and go back and try it again. They're going to have to figure out how they're sending the wrong message to you. It does. It infuriates me. And I do. I understand loving the character. I understand that. I understand wanting the complete run. But, you know, when you get slapped every time you walk through the door, maybe it's time to say, you know what, I could save this $350 and try something else.
We have a friend who, it's been almost our goal to get him away from that mentality. Mm. And, you know, I'm just laughing because I think about this guy. You know, he'll sit there and go, this event was horrible. I go, well, why did you finish reading it then? Mm. Why did you buy all 8 issues of the miniseries, the maxi series that they were doing for this crossover?
And they have the whole thing.
Yeah, why not just stop after 3 if you said it's no good and pick up something that you would have never picked up before and use that same money?
Well, because
and he's starting to get it, but he's still,
Being a collector is an addictive behavior. I mean, we do need to. There's a reason as little kids we collect stuff, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that there's a dopamine pleasure in getting it. It is hard to divorce yourself from that. Normally, what has to happen is it has to hurt you so badly you're like, I'm done. I'm never doing that again.
Which is a shame.
Yeah. Well, but and there's also collecting, and there's being a completionist.
Yes.
You know, and comic book fans, as a general rule, are completionists.
Yeah. And look, you're talking to a writer, my emphasis is always going to be on story. I want good story. I am less concerned with having the complete run.
Yeah.
All right? There was a time when I had to have the complete run. Yeah. You know, but like I said, I'm 44. I'm not the target audience.
What are you reading right now?
If it's written by Bendis, I'm reading it. I'm reading Victories by Mike Oeming. I just lost the name of the book. David Marquez's the 3D. What is it? Joiners in 3D? Is that it?
I'm not familiar with it.
Which I quite like. I really love Pretty Deadly. I think the collaboration between Kelly Sue DeConnick and Emma Rios is just glorious. I hate and loathe everything Matt Fraction does right now. I mean, the guy literally can't put the pen to paper and not be like, oh, God, I was brilliant again. Oh, forgive me. It really is appalling. I mean, honestly, if you want to look at just across the board, and you look at the differences between Hawkeye, Sex Criminals, Satellite Sam. You know, just look at those three. Talk about, you know, an ensemble work. I loved Five Ghosts. Frank Barbieri,
yeah.
I thought was lovely. I really, really enjoyed that. I'm missing a whole bunch of stuff. I got to read, I don't know if it's out yet, I got to read Jason Aaron and Jason Latour's Southern Bastards, the first issue, and I thought that was terrific. Chris Sibilia sent me the first issue of, I want to say, Dead Letters. I get it a lot, and I'm afraid I'm mangling titles, and I really, really, I was actually, and forgive me, Chris, I was actually delighted by how much I enjoyed it. I really liked High Crimes. I thought this was just terrific. I mean, I'm missing a whole bunch of stuff in this, and I know I am. There's stuff I'm forgetting.
Do you read digitally at all? Do you?
I do sometimes. I still like to have a box that we clear. But I do read digitally. I'm finding, you know, digital is somewhat problematic because the royalties are not great, just being as a creator thing. Distribution, lovely. I would like to see us get, you know, Apple takes a big chunk from Comixology sales, and then Comixology, and then, so, you know, the trickle down there. I have no problem with people reading digitally. Like, if you're reading Lazarus digitally, all I would ask is that if you really want to read it digitally, buy it from the image store. It's DRM free. Mm-hmm. You will keep it. It's not in the cloud. You get a download. You can put it wherever you want. It's yours to be backed up forever.
Now you made me feel guilty.
No. I mean, it's not something to feel guilty about. It's just, you know, we're figuring out how to negotiate.
Yeah.
I have not picked up the Thrillbent app yet. I'm really excited to do that when I get home. You know, I Thrillbent. Wade is just, I don't know how he can do so much work so well. I'm overwhelmed with what I've got right now, and I feel the work suffers. And he just, you know, again, hits the bullseye. So I have, he really is... He is. I admire a lot of people in this industry. The longer I do this work, the more I look at people like Wade and Bendis in particular, and I kind of am in awe of their mastery of the form. Because I really do think that, excuse me, In mystery writing, there's the MWA, the Mystery Writers of America, and they give an award, in theory, every year. It's a Grand Master Award, right? They give this award to those writers who they feel are deserving of the title Grand Master, right? The Eisners need something like that, or the Harveys need something like that. We really do need a little plaque that just says, wow. I mean, your whole body of work, wow.
We're going to create something like that for our podcast.
All right, do that.
There you go. It's the Cosmic Cube Award.
I think, you know what? I really do think there needs to be, because we've got a Hall of Fame, but that's very, you know, it's posthumous more than anything else.
Yeah.
We have, in this industry, living treasures.
That's right.
You know, we have people in this industry who I really think, you know, are worthy of being called out and being said, this one over here, she's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, this guy over here, he's outstanding. And not just in writers. I think there are artists that need that too.
And so. You know what? And there's creators here in Calgary, since you're here. We're going to make sure that you check out some of their work.
Okay.
There's some great talent here.
I would love to see it.
We're going
to always looking for people to work with.
All right. Try and get you.
Last words from Greg Rucka. So, anyways, we got Lazarus and Vale.
Yeah.
Vale from Dark Horse.
Yep.
Lazarus from Image.
Yeah, Lazarus is ongoing from Image. Issue 8 just came out. 9 is going to be out in late May. The issue, it's another 24 pages of art as opposed to 22. So we are running late on that. It's frankly as simple as that. It's the last part of that arc. Vale is a 5-issue mini. Issue 3 is coming out shortly. I'm not sure what the drop date on that is. Stumptown is back this fall from Oni Press.
Woo!
Doing Lady Saber and the Pirates of the Ineffable Ether as a webcomic, which has been on hiatus this month, will be back in May because we're fulfilling all our Kickstarter orders. New novel comes out in July. Bravo, second in the Jad Bell series. And I'm working on a whole bunch of other things that I cannot talk about yet. And Cyclops, right. Cyclops issue 1 comes out May 7th, I believe.
Wow. Right.
So, there you go.
All right, Greg Rucka, buy it all.
Thank you.
I also just want to say big thanks to the Calgary Expo because they did a great job and allowed us to hook up a lot of awesome interviews, Greg certainly being one of them. Thanks for listening to We Talk Comics. We are OUT.